That's the nut shot.
Coaches, welcome back to the Talking Split podcast. It would be remiss of us not to explain that, but I'll get into the introductions first before we get to that point. Nick Mihai, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back. I quickly undid my jacket because I was trying to figure out what that scratching noise was. So it's been a while since I've been on it, obviously.
But we may be a little out of practice.
Just for those at home, the scratching noise is the cord from his headphones on his jacket. That's what that is. Not that he's got fleas.
Correct.
No one was going that direction. But as you can hear, obviously Zoe Carr joined us as well. As we jump into this one, the sound grab is for Darren Best, who has exited the buildings in between podcasts in this sort of space. So, Bestie, do want to thank him for the mountain of work he did for Basketball Victoria and in particular with the podcast as well. He's over in the States now coaching at a high school. So that's exciting news for him to be able to jump out. That drop was actually from the first. So Bestie joined us in COVID. So we had a couple of podcasts with him just via Zoom and those sorts of things. That was the one that he did, the first one in person. We were going through it all and I remember when because he was explaining something and he tried to say, that's it in a nutshell, but that's a snapshot of the whole thing, and he ended up with nutshot. And as he said it, he's realised what he said, grabbed his phone and just texted me under the table. He's like, you know, 7 minute mark, you're going to have to take that out, sorry. So we've waited until he's left, but we've managed to put it in there all the same. Never forgotten, Bestie. So, as always, if you can like, share, rate, review, all the good stuff that comes with listening to the podcast, that would be fantastic. The amount of people, and it's kind of my default setting now, that we've seen over probably the last month or so, they're like, hey, we listened to the podcast, and my first thing is not, thanks for listening, that's really good of you. My first thing is rate and review. So, if you haven't left a rating and a review, please do that over the course. It was the amount of people we spoke to at Under 16 Nationals in particular, when that was going, with just, hey, we listen to the podcast, really enjoy it. Like, great. If there's anything you want us to talk about, hit us with it and we'll get onto that over the next little bit as well. So thanks very much to everyone for jumping into that.
You know you make me wanna have my cold chairs, have my cold chairs, have my cold chairs.
Little jangling music you can hear there is Nick dancing on the sides. It's nothing to do with scratching or fleas. It's just him dancing. A little bit of a different coach shout out this week. So this one is a shout out to the Sunbury Jets under 12-3 boys from their coaches Danny and Matt. They're so proud of everyone's amazing efforts and hustle at the recent Ballarat tournament. We had plenty of comments from the opposition teams, families and coaches on how sportsmanlike and how caring the whole team was. Last few games have been a little bit rough and hard on the boys. At the start of the tournament, it wasn't looking bright until there was a turning point in their second game, which ended up meaning we took it all the way to the grand final, becoming runners-up. Blessed to have such an amazing support crew of family and teammates in this group. Just wanted to give a shout-out to everyone for all their work and effort. Fantastic to hear a coach shouting at their team. Normally, we do sit there and say, hey, this is for the coaches, but actually really enjoy that one as well. He does allude to the recent Ballarat tournament. We did get that the week after the Ballarat tournament, and I forgot to put it on there as it turns out. But I've just checked in with them. They have had a little bit of a winning run afterwards, which is a good thing as well. So if you do have any coach shout-outs in particular, by all means, shoot those through and we'll get them on the podcast as early as we can, whether that be for your team as the coach or whether you are looking to give some credit to another coach in that space as well. Since we've been back on the podcast, we've had under 16 Nationals. So Zoe, do you want to give us a little bit of a snapshot of those? The blank look on your face would suggest that one, I haven't prepped you for this, and two, there's been a bit going on since then.
It's been a while ago too.
It feels like an eternity ago. But for us, for the country women, we're so proud of the girls. We had 8 bottom age athletes, which I went in obviously being realistic about and probably a little too realistic towards them, because the way they approached the tournament was just incredible and definitely showed what they could do and really set them up for great things in the future as a group. So that was really exciting, and we saw some athletes really, really step up and you know, come out of their shell a little bit on the big stage, which is really cool to see. So really was really happy with them and how they went. Metro girls were just light years ahead of everybody else, really. I don't think they were even challenged in any game except the grand final up until halftime. And then after that, they just broke it open, which was great. Country Boys were probably a little disappointed with where they finished, but I thought from a team that was mostly guards and long wings, because there wasn't a lot of size in that age group, I thought they performed exceptionally well. The way they were able to put on games where they really showcased how they could shoot the ball, like, it was impressive. So they had, you know, had a great tournament. And then obviously the Metro Boys, again, I don't think they ended up being challenged in a game. Throughout.
Not after day one.
No. Day one was pretty tough with Tassie. But after that, it was almost like that clicked them into gear, and they basically just sailed through and got the gold. So overall, a really impressive and successful tournament for all of our four teams. So, yeah, very exciting.
Well, it's good. It was good to have the Accelerator Women's group up there as well, because we obviously watched a lot of the games together and spoke about sort of the trends and things that we noticed throughout. You mentioned the Country Boys, just the wrong game at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And this is quarterfinal basketball.
Well, and under 16s.
And under 16s. Like, they just ran into a red-hot WA Country on the day, and it was the worst shooting performance those guys had for the course of the week. And I think they came out in the next game in that 5-8 bracket, and I think they stuck maybe 6 or 7 threes in the first quarter against New South Metro. And it's like, you know what, you only need 2 of these yesterday and you would have been in, you know, the top 4 bracket. Yeah. So it's tournaments.
It's what's dangerous when you're so reliant on 3-point shooting as well. Yeah. What was the 3-point shooting like across the board, boys and girls? And was there any significant improvements in anything, or was there disappointments across the board? Like,
actually, across the board, statistically, everything kind of went backwards. But it
perfect.
Is,
yep,
it is
what, yeah, it's what you wanted. Yeah.
It is difficult, though. This is where statistics, and I think we've spoken about this before, statistics can be a bit misleading, because if you took maybe the top 4 to 6 teams and did ran their statistics, you may see an improvement.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's an overall, you know, everything is included, you know, for mine, across the board, defensively, there's been major improvements, which is why I was so disappointed to see so much zone being played. And in boys and girls.
So they weren't using it as a change-up?
No.
They were just
sitting in it.
Just
for,
I think the danger was that there would be teams that would start in a match-up, go to a zone as a change-up, it would work, and then it'd never come off again. And that was kind of the difference.
It was always plan B.
Yep.
So if a team did start to, you know, score, go on a bit of a run, bang, zone. And that was frustrating, because I actually thought when teams were matched up, they looked better. They looked really good, and I thought I saw improvement in that, but how can we judge, because, you know, we're sitting in so much zone. So it would have been nice to see a little bit more of that. You know, my coaching staff copped some
conversations.
Yeah,
I gotcha.
Well played, Nick. We'll put that one down as an assist for you.
and we're able to make the adjustment, which was great, but that was where I was the most proud of my girls, because defensively up the floor, they were incredible. Staying in front of the ball, chest blows, you know, just absolute aggression. You know, it was great.
Is there a danger for you now? Like, and I don't think this is a look behind the curtain by any stretch of the imagination, but because they've held themselves really well this year with 8 bottom age kids, do you worry about the complacency thing of, oh, this was just, we'll worry about the good stuff next year when we're top age kids and we'll be fine when we come into this? Like, is that something that you think you're going to have to deal with now?
Well, there's no guarantee that those 8 will make it next year.
Yep.
We've got a really good group of top age under 14s coming up into 15s, and we've also got some kids that have been in that age group working their butts off. Yep. So their spot is not guaranteed. So there's that puts it on the, oh, I've got to make sure I perform, and continue to work. But that's also a mindset that is just unacceptable in our culture. So I would like to think no, but, you know, I suppose we'll wait and see. It might be a lesson that they have to learn. But, you know, at the end of the day, our culture of my program, a big part of it is gratitude and being grateful for opportunities that you've been given. And so if you're walking into a tournament thinking, you know, oh, well, we've got this because we were good last year and we had 8 bottom ages and now we're all top age, and that's not being grateful for the opportunity. That's taking advantage of that opportunity. So I would, yeah, like I said, I would hope to think no.
Because we have seen it before.
We have.
With teams that go with a largely bottom age contingent for a year,
yep.
Everyone comes back the next year thinking, oh, we'll be fine here, and you're not fine. Like, it'd be naive to sit there and think that everyone else isn't improving in that space as well.
Exactly.
And they also, yeah, they come back with the feedback of,
yeah,
well, I made it last year, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, and it's, we make sure we say it as loudly and as often as possible that just because you make it as a bottom major doesn't mean you make it as a top.
Even just, on a podcast, it turns out.
Yeah. but that's how it has to be, because if we've got this, you know, mentality of, you know, oh, well, now we make it, where's the competition to continue to get better?
Yep.
You know, mm-hmm. So, yeah, I like I said, I'd like to think we wouldn't be experiencing that. But if we do, they'll find out pretty quick.
Yep, absolutely. So when we're talking shooting percentages, so with thanks to HoopsDB, Duncan Berg puts this together that people use. So on the boys' side, three-point percentage down at 24%. Free throw percentage 59.9%. On the women's side, 3-point percentage down at 23.3% and free throw percentage at 58.4%.
Is there any way to, I don't know if DB Stats has this, but like possessions per game, has that gone up in the previous year? Is that it?
I'd have to do a further dive into that, which I'm not going to do right now. But yeah, there probably
we've
is.
Just winged like this, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Like this is not.
No, so the shooting percentage is not great. Clearly, and it is a bit of a reflection of under-16s in that it's probably the first time they're seeing zone defenses extensively. Like we were talking about the bottom age group in particular, they've really seen 8 months worth of zone because they can't see it in 12s and 14s. They come to 16s, and of course it brings everything to a screeching halt. So the type of shot they're getting when they're getting the shot is a big part of it, like because they are like it's usually a guards tournament under-16s. You don't tend to have giants playing in that one, so they are a lot of guards, so there's a lot more dribble involved with that. But the amount of times we saw over the course of the week, shot clock down at 5, 4, 3, and the person with the ball would just go, oh, that's a problem, I'll pass it to someone else. It's like, no, that's on you. You have to create the play on that one. So it's shot going up with very late clock, those types of things. The free throw shooting percentage, no excuse. Like that was a free throw.
But that's been horrible for a long time. And it's hard because we talk about it as HP coaches, like what can we do and this and that. And there's this real fight, like almost internal struggle, because if we block out parts of our session to shoot free throws, then a lot of people are standing around doing nothing while that's happening. And so then we get like judged for that too. Nobody has enough courts where they're training to be able to,
or just rings on the sidelines.
Continue their session and then say, hey, run over there, shoot 2 free throws and then come back. You know, like it's just free throws has got to be on the athlete. That's the one thing they can practice.
Or they're skills trainers. Like instead of showing me 18 crossovers into a pull-up step back, how about we just get to the foul line and get some rhythm into the shots?
And you get some serious credibility if you improved free throw percentages.
Well, that's very trackable.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That's something that is you can track that and see a genuine improvement. But across the board, free throws was a big problem, boys and girls.
And cost people games. It did. Like we saw it multiple times
during
the week.
Cost us games.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. We saw it multiple times during the week where the last 3 minutes would come into it and people would clunk free throws. And even if they've been like 4 or 5 to that point, they go empty on 2. It's like that's enough. Like that's a stop for the defense in that sort of space. So free throw shooting is a genuine concern, I think, across the board. And I mean, we can probably do a whole separate pod on what that looks like and some things to get better at, because, I mean, there's not a coach alive that doesn't go to a box score after a game if you have you know, access to one and go to the foul line percentage.
Mm.
Everyone does it.
Like, free throws and rebounds.
Yeah, they're the two straight away, and turnovers if you're going to go to a third one. They tend to be the three straight away. And part of it is like we didn't get there enough, so that might be why they're looking at it. But part of it is how many points did we leave on the court that we should have taken with us? That is an issue. And a part of it, again, is an under-16s tournament. They are young athletes, and that is something that we do have to be mindful of, is some of these kids are 14 and 15, and just because they look like adults doesn't mean they are adults. And that is both in the mental aspect but also the skill set aspect of what that looks like. But we do have to be conscious that I think as players, they have to do more work in their own time of getting a technique, but they also have to shoot it fatigued. There's no point of just walking up to the foul line and just going, okay, shoot. Well, that's not what it looks like in a game. Every now and again, you might have to sub in cold if, like, someone's got blood on their singlet or something, and you might have to shoot something cold. But the reality is you're probably shooting a free throw because you've been fouled, which means you've probably put the ball on the floor, you're driving, so there's a little bit of, like, the heavy breathing, those sorts of things. You are fatigued. Yes, you need to make free throws in the first quarter, but the ones that really matter are the ones in the fourth quarter. Or potentially the third quarter. The fourth quarter may not matter so much if you've made your free throws after the third quarter because the game's already done. And the amount of times we saw it during the course of the week where coaches would reflect back and say, oh, you know, in the last 2 minutes, this. So don't worry about the last 2 minutes. Like, worry about the third quarter where you didn't put the team away when you had the opportunity to put the team away. You were flippant with the ball. Like, those sorts of things make a difference. And we saw it.
Yeah, Kilsyth are probably not looking at that last possession, right, in NBL 1.
No.
The Tigers, they're probably looking at, all right, we had an 18-point lead. What happened there?
Yeah, exactly
what
right.
What did we do right? When did we stop doing it? Like,
yep, exactly right. There's more to it. And yeah. I think free throws are an easy one because it's very trackable game to game.
Mm.
It's probably one of the few skills that you can guarantee consistency with over the course of how it would look. But it is. Like, what happened before those free throws? But could you have avoided being in that situation? Like, that's the reality of it. So,
well, it's free throws. Often free throws can be the thing that wrestle momentum back for your team, and it sounds odd because the whole game stops and things. But you think about, you know, you're in an arm wrestle with a team, you get a three-point play and everyone's up and everyone's about. You knock that third point in from the free throw line. God, I hate that.
It's hard to say.
But you hit that. And now all of a sudden, that's enough to just inject so much energy into your group. You miss that and it's like, oh.
Well, if you go empty on some possessions in a row and all of a sudden, look, you might have a player that is struggling a little bit from the field. And like, there were certainly players that did this during the week. Their field goal percentage was down lower than where it would normally be, obviously. But they do a great job of getting themselves to the foul line. Mm. And all of a sudden, that alleviates some pressure. They see the ball go through the ring. They start feeling good about themselves. They're not worried about their field goal percentage anymore because the scoreboard's still ticking over as it goes with it. And there are a lot of times, and this is not a criticism of the refing at all, but there were plenty of times where teams were in the bonus early. Like, I think there was one game where both teams were in the bonus a minute and a half into a quarter. And yeah, it's like, right. So you're spending 8.5 minutes shooting free throws. That's a lot of points out there. So having to adjust to the style of how the game's being called as well makes a massive difference in that.
Are all the teams playing at a faster pace as well?
Yep.
I'm not trying to find an excuse. I'm just thinking fatigue might impact the free throws as well, which goes back to what you need to work on, right?
Yep.
Like, but also the three-point shooting percentage as well. Like the fatigue, definitely, because of the pace that they were playing at. And under-16s is so unpredictable because they are so young. You look at that, the country men, and there were games where they were busting out leads by 20 because they're just constantly hitting from the 3-point line. And it wasn't a fluke. Like, they did it in regularly.
They were good shots. Yeah.
And they were the right shots to take and all created the right way. But then you get that one game where you're a little bit off and then everything tightens up and that's exactly what that quarter final was for them. But because everybody's up and down so much quicker now, fatigue from the three, I think, definitely set in.
Yep. And they're not used to having to shoot that shot at tempo.
Mm. And not at that tempo.
And that's the biggest jump, I think, for a lot of kids. yes, they might be really good representative basketball level kids, but they don't realize how big a jump it is to go to a nationals and just how much quicker, how much more physical, the amount of time you have to get your shot away just reduces so dramatically. It's a different type of basketball. And until you're in it, and it is usually about the midpoint of the week where teams start to sort of figure it out a little bit, and what looks like a really good player on day one may not be on day five or six. But then you see the kids going the other way where it's like, okay, I have figured this out now. Now I know where I can pick my moments and those sorts of things too. It's just, and it's no different than going from domestic basketball to representative basketball. Your opportunities are different. And when you go from representative basketball into a national tournament, your opportunities are different, or they're reduced. When you go from a national tournament into Australian teams, it's reduced. Like we are talking about the best kids when we get to this point. So it is difficult to try and really quantify what works. Like there are some commonalities for sure, but overall it's just a little bit of a sounding out process for a lot of kids that haven't been there before, and that's an adjustment for the coach who has to try and keep them on the right track. That's an adjustment for the parents who are probably used to seeing their kid drop 25 points on a weekend. All of a sudden it's like, oh, okay, they don't get those same shots anymore. It's like, no, because they're being scouted.
Can we talk about parent behaviour?
Well, if you want, yeah.
Let's do this.
It was bad. It was bad.
Over the week?
Yep.
Okay.
It was really bad.
All states?
All states, oh, yep.
So
everybody.
Many pool noodles.
Oh, my God.
So many
pool noodles. Yeah, well, that's not that, the that's, bad
that,
behaviour.
I noticed that first at the club chants, was it last year?
Yeah, full on. Drums.
Constant drumming was an issue. But, no, I'm talking more about the things that they're saying in the stands, the things that they're yelling out to their kids, the things that they're just so happy to have other parents hear when they're talking about. Like if I can hear it sitting, I generally sit away, try and sit away, as do most of the high performance coaches, because we're often having to talk about kids for, trying to put them on depth charts and stuff like that. So we didn't want to do that within an earshot of parents. But if I can hear some of the things that they're saying, I can only imagine what it must be like when you sit with the full group. But it's becoming a real issue, and kids are looking more to their parents during the game than they are their coach. And it's got to stop, and I don't know how to stop it. I understand, you're riding the highs and lows with your child, and you want so bad for them, but it's hurting them. It's hurting them. It's hurting their team, and it's not really doing them any favors.
Well, there was one stage, I think our women's group was sitting in the stand because they would sit together and talk about, what are you seeing, how are you observing this, and those sorts of things. At one stage, I think it was halftime of a game, they came and sort of sat where I was, which was away from everyone else, and like, we can't sit near that parent group anymore. They're crazy.
Yeah.
Like legitimately crazy. We came in the next morning and it was a different team altogether, and it's like you should hear some of the stuff that player X's parents are saying about some of the other kids. It's like, what are you doing? Like, this is not a healthy environment. And there are times where you'd walk through the foyer and you'd overhear conversations and those sorts of things too. And it's like you're having this conversation with your child in public that people can hear, where you are actively bagging on, other teammates, other teams, other coach, and it's anything from physical appearance through to shot selection and everything and anything in between. And it's just like, adults, please be adults. Yeah. And I get it. Self-awareness is not always a strong suit with a lot of people. There are times that I failed at that and everything else. But just have a little bit of awareness as to what your actions, whether it be physical actions, your verbal actions, just your thought. How many thoughts go through your head that don't need to make it out of your head, that you don't need to project onto other people, that you don't feel the need to stand up in the middle of a grandstand and yell at a ref about something? Like, do you need to do that? Is this a good representation of you? And there are a couple of parents that you could see didn't feel comfortable with what was going on around them and removed themselves from that area. Or it's like, hey, I'm not sitting with this. I don't want to be.
Which is sad. It's disappointing.
Really sad.
Because they're there to see their son or daughter. They should have every right to sit there and be comfortable to sit there as well.
And lucky we were in a venue that had more seats than people. Because sometimes they're not available and you are stuck in those positions. But, even the amount of times I'd walk through the foyer and you'd hear parents talking to their kids Like they'd obviously just finished a game or something like that. And their kids are fine as they approach them, and then their parents start talking about, you know, what they did wrong and what they should have done or what should have been afforded to them and all this. And they all automatically start either getting upset or crying or – and it's just you're right. It's sad. It's really sad. And I don't know what we do. I don't know how we fix it, because we don't want a game where, okay, all parents are outside, because having atmosphere is – awesome.
Yeah, not pool noodles and not drums. Not pool noodles like, and I drums. Draw the line there.
But having that atmosphere and teaching them how to play in front of people, and it's so important. But it's just
– you feel for the kids.
I do. And like thankfully, again, if they were on court one it was fine, because they're probably far enough away that, you know, things couldn't be heard anyway for the athletes. But the other courts, they're right there. You know, we even had parents. There was an incident where a parent from a state stood up and had a go at kids that were cheering for the other team after they'd won. Like, what?
Yeah, you probably don't need to fire shots at a random 9-year-old in the stand.
I had to just take a second and process.
Yeah,
like,
that
what?
Happened. Yep. And it's just sad. It used to be that sort of behaviour was the minority, and it's fast becoming, you know, whether it be even or the majority, it's getting out of control, and it's not helping anybody.
And probably a little different at a nationals from say the regular parents that are at, say, domestic basketball and representative basketball. But as a coach, because I am aware that most of the people listening to this probably would be coaches, one, if you're a parent, reflect a little. When you hit the car, it's like, geez, was I the best version of myself here? Maybe not. But coaches, please address this with your parents as well. If you do see them getting a little bit untidy on the sidelines, bring it up. I've long had that opinion that the problem that goes away by itself will probably come back by itself. So don't just sit there, it's just one night. No, one night turns into three nights very quickly. And it's just a chat on the sidelines like, hey, I get that you're passionate about this. I get that you're fully invested. I understand the hours, the finances, the liters of petrol, the time, everything that goes into this matters. And it's not easy to do. And we're really conscious of that as well, that it is getting to be a more and more expensive sport depending on the level you play at and those sorts of things. But just remind them what they're actually there for in the first place, which is their child, and are they leaving them in a better place than when they first got there, or are they making it harder for that kid to come back? Because there are plenty of kids that were embarrassed about parent behaviour that didn't want to look you in the eye when you were trying to deliver feedback, as an example, because they're like, all I can see at the corner of my eye is mum and dad with full face painted, you know, Viking horns on, you know, yelling at someone else with a pool noodle. Like, it's those types of things.
Yeah, but it's also a case of, if you think you're getting away with it because you're not sitting near your high performance coach or what, and this is all states, I'm not talking just specifically Victorians. Yep. If you think you're getting away with it, you're not. There's always somebody around. We talk about it with the athletes all the time. You never know who's watching. You don't know who's sitting near you and what their job is or who they know. And the amount of messages that get back to all the high performance coaches, and the, you know, the COE coaches and those, you know, Oz coaches and those sort of things, those messages get back, and they get back really quickly. Now,
oddly enough, bad behavior gets talked about quicker than good behavior.
Yeah, well, because good behavior should be the norm.
Yeah,
well,
that's what we would expect.
Yeah, it should be. Yeah, it should. Unless you hear it from me, you're doing okay. Yeah. That's what it should be, right?
But it's
just cheer and clap. Like, I don't, you know, maybe I'll understand better when Orlando's a little bit older. But like, I don't understand either. Like, I go watch my niece and nephew play. At no point do I think, I'm going to get this ref. It's really disappointing, you know. And but I'm an active coach when I'm coaching, like I'm up and down the sideline. But when I'm watching, I just go, oh, cool, she made a basket. That's awesome. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's.
And funnily enough, you've brought us back wonderfully on a tangent here, Nick, because we're talking about assistant coaches today. Mm. And I can tell you categorically, my ability to decompartmentalize what's going on as an assistant coach is far better than when I'm a head coach. Like, I feel like when I'm the head coach, I am the person that's in charge of everything. So if there's a ref call I don't like, if there's a sub I need to make, like if there's player feedback, I really struggle to think through strategically how I'm going to do that. As an assistant coach, it's like, oh, well. What's next? And that's
because you're likely not the one that's going to get fired.
Absolutely,
it's not your name on the line.
Exactly.
But this is the part of being an assistant coach. Obviously, is the all care no responsibility part of things. But more and more, I am hearing assistant coaches getting lumped in with head coaches when people are talking about them. It's like, the coaches don't know what they're doing or have made a mistake with this and those sorts of things. So we are talking assistant coaches just off the bat. What are some of the things, Nick, that you look at and you say that is a great assistant coach? Like when you're watching a game, what stands out to you straight away with an assistant coach?
What stands out to me is you can clearly identify that they have a role. I think that's really important. So I was at the CMC recently as well, and there was a few assistants that were just on the sideline with the head coach and they're both yelling on the court. Okay, so like having a defined role, understanding that if I see an assistant grab every kid on a sub off and they're getting subbed off, they go and they go have a little chat to them about what they can improve on, or they're prepping kids to be subbed on. That's really important to me. The other thing is if you have a notepad, and I know it sounds crazy, but like you should be studying something that helps you in game. It doesn't need to be a box score necessarily, but something that is impacting a game. I think we still have, I got it from David Crow, 4 ways of scoring stat sheet.
Yep.
Like if anyone wants that, just email me. I'll send it to you if you want it. It's it just gives you a snapshot of where the opposition is scoring, whether they're scoring in the low post or wherever it is, and it gives you a little bit of a picture as well. So they're the two things, seeing a role when they're getting subbed off, for example, and then having a notebook in their hand.
Yep. What about you, Zoe?
Elite communicator. So if you're going to be an assistant coach, you need to be able to recognize things that are happening and communicate them quickly. There's nothing worse than having to wait for somebody to take, and I know it doesn't sound like long, but 30 seconds to get their point across. We don't have 30 seconds. So somebody who can, you know, bring solutions and communicate them quickly can. And the other thing would be build relationships with athletes and mend relationships a little bit, because for mine, when I was head coaching, you know, I'd get into the athlete and I'd often turn to you, Rob, and say, hey, I'm about to let her have this. Talk to her about A, B and C. And then, you know, I'd have the have a bit of a swipe, they'd go sit down. And so being able to have that relationship with them to explain exactly what it meant to align with the head coach and make sure that, you know, there's not the, I don't agree with that either. Like, I don't think that's right. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that align with that head coach and then communicate what's happening and what's expected of them next. But for mine, I can work with any assistant coach with any sort of weakness as long as they can effectively communicate.
And also on top of that, just to bounce off that one, don't be sensitive as an assistant coach, because the head coach is probably a lot of the times not going to do what you say, but your job is to provide suggestions.
Yeah.
This is what I believe is happening. This is what I believe should be the counter to it.
Can I also say though, I know we're talking about assistant coaches, but I see a lot of really terrible behaviour from head coaches because they think they can to their assistant coach. I don't think just because you are a head coach, that gives you the right to turn around and abuse your assistant coach for a suggestion that they've made. Horrible behaviour.
I've seen that as well, I think it's disgusting.
It is disgusting. I think you can be direct, no problem, but some of the, I'm on a bit of a behaviour rant, obviously, today.
I feel
but,
that way.
I thought you were going back to the parents again. So this is good.
Car ride home's going to be rough today.
I feel like there's some coaches out there, and I've seen them and I've worked with them, that think that, you know, they've got to be this big, tough, you know, and the assistant coach bears the brunt of it. That's where I feel like assistant coaches get to be a little bit sensitive and say, hey, stop treating me like this. Mm. Like, but when it's things like... you know, you've suggested a change up for pick and roll coverage or something like that, and the coach hasn't done it, there's no need to get offended by that. That's just their decision. But continue. I see a lot of coaches, when that does happen, sit back and go, "Oh, I'm going to say nothing now."
They shut down.
And it's
bit,
like, no, keep going, keep throwing it at them. They'll tell you to stop if you know it's too much. Because what we're looking for as head coaches are solutions, and so your suggestion might not be what they do, but it might be enough to trigger something in the head coach's mind that they do something different. You are still a part of that. Like, you have still helped create that. So continue to give those solutions if you can.
In my earlier years assisting as well, I would give suggestions. They obviously weren't used. And when I did shut down, the head coach actually got annoyed. The good ones anyway. They're just like, "What are you doing? Why you got to be telling me this stuff?" Like, so it makes you realize, like, they want this. Sometimes it just helps them process things, like you were saying, Zoe. Yep.
But having also the ability to step in if you need to. So one of the things that drives me a little bit mental with assistant coaches is, because they're the assistant coach, they think they can swan in and out of practice. Like, if we're talking state teams, for example, "Oh, well, I'm not the head coach, so I'm going to go to, you know, this senior game or whatever that I'm going to do instead because I'm just the assistant coach." Well, we had a situation last year where the head coach couldn't coach the first three games, and assistant coach had to do that. So you need to be across all of the offense, all of the defensive schemes, all of the, you know, the main rotations and things like that. You've got to be just as on top of that as the head coach does. Just because you're the assistant doesn't mean you get to phone it in.
And even at the domestic level, if you're lucky enough to have an assistant, like, if you're the assistant coach, at the very least, know your players.
Mm.
Know who you believe should start, when they should be rotating, what they're running, that sort of stuff, like real basic stuff. But yes, absolutely.
That's a lot.
That was a lot.
Straight off the bat from both of you. Not a bad thing.
Done.
Yeah, good. Yeah.
See you next week.
Not how this works, believe it or not. But one of the big things, and you hear it a lot with coaching teams in particular, is the good cop, bad cop type mentality. I'm not convinced that exists. Like, I think you need to be a foil to your coach at times, like you spoke about before, Zoe. There are times where it's like, hey, you might need to pick up some pieces here, but you just need to find a cohesive, complementary skill set. And that's the biggest thing in particular. That, well, okay, can I not make up for the shortcomings of what my head coach is, but can I fill the gaps where they may not be as great at something? Can I be that person that can be? And when you look at who your assistant coaches are, there's different types of assistant coaches, I feel like, because there are some that you look at and say, well, look, they've been put there as a bit of a support mechanism for the head coach. They might, like, the head coach might be a little bit raw, may not be ready enough for it or prepared for it. So you've gone and got an experienced assistant coach to put there. There are times where the head coach might be quite well advanced with their learning and their understanding of things, and you go and put a younger, less experienced coach there as a way to, hey, you can learn from this person. Mm-hmm. There might be a specific skill set that works in. You might be great with tech, or, you know, you might have a real niche, hey, great zone person. Like, it's, I remember there was a Team USA group at one stage, and Jim Boeheim was the guy for that coaching staff that was the zone guy. And Kobe Bryant just laughed. Like, we're not zoning anyone. We're America. We don't need to zone. Like, you can sit there. That's fine. Like, and Jim Boeheim, like, great coach, Syracuse guy and all that sort of stuff. But he's like, you're going to be the least used person on this coaching staff because we don't need to zone anyone. But that might be a niche type role that you have to have within that coaching staff as well. How would you go about establishing roles? Because you spoke about it before, like, you want clear roles with your coaching staff. How do you go about establishing roles with them? Do you lean into their strengths, or do you try and find what their weaknesses are and work on that as part of their development as the assistant coach?
I definitely go to strengths, yep, first and foremost, because I do tend to think about the players first, but I would also support them on their weaknesses as well. A lot of the times their strengths are, like you said, are filling gaps that I have as well in my coaching. But yeah, like, in general, I would definitely lean towards strengths.
Yep, where are you, Zach?
I hate it. You're going to hate this. But
with the parents.
Oh, dear. You might have to edit it out otherwise. What I would say is it does depend on who I've got. So if I've got two like if I had you two, for example, as my assistant coaches, I'm leaning into your strengths. No questions asked.
Can find a kebab place after the game.
Like well, that would strength. Be my strength. Yeah. So
you just bring out the cob loaf or whatever it is.
And I'd have an app for, you know, radius.
But if I had a very experienced assistant coach and then a developing coach, I would actually lean into the strengths of the experienced coach and lean into the weaknesses of the developing coach, because that's why they're there. They're there to try and get better. And if I only use their strengths, they're not going to get better. They're just going to stay the way they are. So I would try and push them. But I would also use, and like I've done it with you before, Rob, where I would use that experienced assistant coach, particularly in games, to make sure that, you know, what's coming through isn't something that's going to be detrimental, because obviously if you're at the NBL 1 level or higher, you know, things matter. But if you're, you know, in a VJBL space or something like that and you're an experienced coach, you've probably got the ability to filter that as the game's going. It's not going to sort of hurt you as much. I really believe head coaches have a responsibility to develop their assistant coaches particularly if they've got ambition to try and go further, whether that be in that league or, you know, try and get a first team or try and get a state team job or something like that. I think head coaches really have that responsibility to try and help foster that.
Can I ask a question for both of you? Because I get this question a lot. What about the assistant that is roped into it? Like a parent that's just like, hey, I'll put my hand up because no one wants to do it. How do you get them involved? How do you get them started?
As an assistant coach?
Yeah.
To begin with? Yeah. I think the most tangible thing that you can give them early on is time to work their way into the role. They'll have an understanding, say, if it is a parent, that they'll know how their child functions, but they probably don't have a feel for the dynamic of the group yet, especially early on in the season. So even giving them basic little things to do like stats is a great way to integrate them into it. Again, make sure that you refer back to those stats, because no one likes work for the sake of work. So if you're going to sit there and say, I need you to count how many passes they make, it's like, well, okay, this is kind of boring work. And are you actually going to use this, or are you just trying to keep me busy?
I actually have a story about that. Story time. It's not a funny one, maybe it is. But anyway, this coach was telling me that he did a scout, prepared this playbook of what the opposition were running, and then said, hey, look, I've done all this work for you. He goes, oh, that's great. Thank you. I really appreciated it. And the coach, when the training finished, left it on the bench at training.
Yeah.
So I was just left there. Yep. So straight away, like, how does the assistant feel when he's gone and done all that?
You've got to value that work.
Yeah, like respect the assistant.
It is. And so once they're through that, and I'll come back to tracking fouls in a second, because that's a different tangent I'll come back to. But I think the biggest thing early on, if they are someone that's, I'll say, roped into it, that maybe doesn't have the experience yet, find some things that they're good at. If you are a parent coach and you have a parent assistant coach, start with your child. Like, can you coach my child in this space? Just so it gives a little bit of separation between the role. They might have basketball experience. They might not have. They might have people management experience. They might, you know, be a different sport altogether, but understand communication really well. They might be a teacher. Who knows? But find out what their strengths are and give them small tasks and gradually build up to it. Because I think the biggest thing you want is a sense of loyalty with your head coach and your assistant coach. And I think part of that is you need to understand them off the court before you can work together on the court. Because on the court is always when it's more heated. You have to make decisions quickly. You have to give a really direct snapshot of what's going on and feedback. You need to know, if I say this to this person, will that trigger a bad response? Can I say that to them? Because I've been on staffs before. I like to think I'm largely bulletproof as an assistant coach. You can say whatever you want. It's like, yeah, whatever. Like, it's fine. But I know I've worked with other coaches that will hear the same thing and go, gee, I don't like how that was delivered. And I was like, well, that's fine. Like, you don't have to, but, you know, ultimately, I know I've worked with head coaches. It's like, fire away. Tell me whatever you want, however you want to do it, that's fine. But they understand me well enough to know that that's the case, but they have to understand the other assistant well enough to know that that's not the case with them. So similar deal, you want to make sure that anything is discussed between the two of you doesn't go anywhere else. Like, it stays within that coaching group rather than your assistant coach runs off and tells the other parents in the group, oh, this has happened, dangerous.
Yeah, when that happens, it's a disaster, isn't it?
It is. You don't want to be undermined in that sort of space.
It's not so much about parents, but...
it'll get there eventually.
I had an experience with an assistant coach. So it was actually with you, Rob, and...
Was I the assistant coach?
That's what I was going to ask.
You were actually the role model of what an assistant coach should do. So we were in a game.
Nice.
Yeah.
Want to clip that one out.
We were in a game and Rob came up and said, I think you need to get this player out. And I said, in a couple of possessions. And so he sat down and the other assistant coach leaned into Rob and goes, I agree with you. And Rob turned to him. And said,
wrong dude to say that to.
I don't care.
So maybe I haven't come across in the greatest of lights that I thought I was going to initially.
No,
it's what he built you up at the start.
But because as an assistant coach, as a head coach, I need to know that is what's happening when that behaviour starts on the bench because I didn't hear it. I was in the game, so I didn't hear any of that. And so it was like, you know, if you are an assistant coach, you've got to have your coaches back, whether you agree with them, whether you don't agree with them. At the end of the day, they've got to trust that you are there to not only help the team but to help them. And that sort of behaviour is not at all helpful.
You have to be aligned.
You do. Because
and that starts the off the
second,
court, I think.
Yeah, and the second that breaks – You start to wonder why the head coach doesn't talk to you anymore.
But not only that, coaching is a small world and coaches talk and you don't want a reputation of being that type of person either.
Yeah.
Yep. And that's a dangerous part. So trying to find the right personalities to coach with you I think is a really important part of it because I certainly know what I would perceive to be my strengths are or personality types are as a coach. I don't want someone that's exactly like me as an assistant coach. Like I don't think that's helpful. Like there's more than enough of me to go around as a coach, but I want someone that is going to provide a different layer, I suppose, coming through on that one. So when I'm looking for an assistant coach, because there are times, and I mean, this is just the reality of it. Sometimes you get to choose your assistant coaches. Sometimes your assistant coaches are chosen for you. And it's like, hey, they will be assisting because they are a coach that's been in their program. They don't want to coach their child, but we want you to have them as the assistant coach. And that might be a little bit of a power dynamic because they might have been a head coach previously and they've gone to an assistant role now and they may struggle with that.
Have you ever had that?
Yeah, constantly.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, I've had that a few times.
And it's
tough.
A lot of the times it hasn't worked out for me.
Yep. It's, to be honest, more often than not it has for me.
Yeah, okay.
And it's been usually a real direct conversation at the start
is
how this has to work.
What's the difference between... the two. What was your approach?
Well, I don't think there's necessarily differences in I did it right and Nick did it wrong.
No.
I think it's just the personality type of the person you're dealing with.
Yeah, right.
It's more a case of, look, are you here? Because there have been plenty of times where I've had a parent and their job was to come in and learn. It's like, well, okay, cool. Like if that's the lens that you're going to look at this through, no worries. There have been other times where it's been a parent that has been there with, hey, if I'm the assistant coach, I think I can push my child's case here. It's like, wrong person. Like, it's like, if anything, I'm more likely to go the other way because, again, that's my personality type where it's just like, oh, you think this? I think differently. It's that kind of thing. So I think it's really early on, what do you want out of this role? Like, what do you want out of this? And this is me. And I'm fortunate enough that I have obviously had experience as a coach and an assistant coach. It's like, well, look, for now, what do you want out of this role? And if it's like, look, I want to learn, great, no worries. Let's look at it through that lens. If it's like, hey, I think I can really help you with X, Y, and Z, okay, let's see where that works in the whole grand scheme of things. Like the last assistant coach I had, former Opal elite person and communicator, brilliant. She was a great foil to me because even when I was a little bit upset and irate on things, her calming demeanor was perfect. She could go in there and just like, hey, this – it's like, yep, got it, no worries. And she was very good at working out, he's about to lose it, and was brilliant at distracting me at the right time where I would stop getting focused on something that really didn't matter in the grand scheme of things and bring me back to kind of reality. But again, we established that early on by trying to work out, well, okay, where do you fit, where do I fit, and what's it look like for the two of us? And it doesn't always work, but I think establishing very clear lines of communication early on helped that.
Yeah, for me, it was personality is definitely a big one. I just felt that most of them that came to me that I didn't go and source myself had an agenda of I want that team in the future and I can start talking to players and parents. You know, those sorts of things are parent agendas. It just didn't really work for me. I'd rather be selective. I need them to be a certain type of person, personality-wise and stuff as well. So because obviously I have a weird sense of humor, and then off the court I'll crack jokes, and if people that I'm working with don't get those jokes, they'll be like, you are a weird guy. Yeah. I'm going to go tell the parents. I had instances, for example, like I had a coach and I said, hey, this is the stuff I want you to do. I'd really like you to like stat this and stat that. And then he goes, nah, that's not really me. What I like to do is kind of like, you know, communicate on the floor and then like manage subs and things like that. And I go, that's my job though. So it's like, we can't both do it. That's just my experience from it. I'm not saying that all of it is the case. Like, I'm sure there's people that nominate and say, you've got this assistant and they've been awesome and they've probably stayed assistants together in the future.
I'd say a couple like that have started as two parents coaching their kids in the same team. Their kids have finished playing and they've just kept coaching together. And it's like, that's great.
That's awesome.
It's
awesome.
A little romance on the side that you two have got going on over there. Like that. But that's what they do. Like, there's just two dads that really enjoyed coaching together and they just keep doing it. And it's like, well, fantastic. If you can find a relationship that works for both of you, that works for the players as well, perfect.
I think
they are hard to find.
Yeah, I think one of the things as an assistant coach that is the most important is your job is to take problems away from the head coach. So don't be another one of those problems in the way you're behaving. You know, as you mentioned before, Nick, the basketball community is quite small, and if it gets out that you're somebody that's behaving, you know, because you're trying to angle to get the job, or, you know, that people are going to find that out pretty quickly. And it's hard to come back from. Like, you got to do a lot of work to remove that from your name. But even in game in particular or in practice, you know, be the coach that, you know, if you're statting fouls, for example, be great at that. So then, you know, the second that your player gets a, you know, their second foul in the first quarter, you know, you're telling the head coach before the ball can be inbounded again so they can make that adjustment really quickly, make that sub really quickly so they don't pick up their third. You know, when you go to with a suggestion, you go with a solution. So it's not we're getting killed off the pick and roll. Well, the head coach, I can assure you, can see that. You can still say we're getting killed off the pick and roll. We need to change our coverage to switch or whatever it is that you need to go to. But go with solutions. Take problems off their plate. You're at practice and you see that at some point you've got three teams of three, for example, if you're lucky enough to get nine at your practice. So preload those teams. Make those teams. So you're like A, B and C, you're in black. You know, the next group, you're in white. I'm trying to think of bland colours so I'm not aligning it with a club.
I thought you had a moment where it's like, what comes after C?
We are horrible assistants, by the way.
I've been singing the alphabet a lot to my niece lately, so no, I'm well across that. But that's what I mean, like preload those teams so that happens quickly. So you're on the floor quickly, and it's, again, another thing your head coach doesn't have to do. But as a head coach, if you want those things, you also need to be organized in the sense that your assistant coach gets the session plan with enough time to do that for you and all those sort of things. So it's working together. But, yeah, I think one of the main points is just just take problems off the head coach's plate. Because
I think being specific with the issues in solutions is a big one. Like, how many times have you had it over the years? I've had it many times where an assistant will go, "We just need a box out." Yeah, I know.
Sick.
Thanks.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean don't talk, but maybe, hey, this player isn't boxing out. We need to address – like, there's different ways to do it. Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. it's – you do have to be really conscious that you're not giving them busy work. One of the areas – and you sort of touched on it a little bit before, Zoe, and I mentioned it earlier as well – the fouls. Like, in particular, the amount of times when we were sitting at Nationals, we would see a player pick up a foul. And I don't know what it is about your personality, Zoe, but you have an innate ability to sit there and go, that's their third. Like, even if you're not paying attention to the game, there are times I'd be talking to Zoe and it's like she's paying zero attention to what I'm saying here, and I can completely understand that. But all of a sudden, a whistle would go and she's like, that's their third foul. I'm like, you haven't been watching this game. How on earth would you know that? All of a sudden, the paddle comes up, third foul. It's like, all right, cool. The amount of times it took an eternity for the assistant coach to identify that and then make a sub or communicate that to the head coach, I think I saw four times over the tournament the player would pick up another foul in the next possession.
Well, especially with under 16s.
Yeah, like, because they tend to foul quickly.
Yeah, yeah, like one foul generally turns into two.
Is it those assistants, it's their first campaign?
Well, maybe the speed. I don't know, because to be fair, they weren't all coaches.
Because that was my job when, what was it, 2019.
Yep.
2019 when I went with Dom as well. And I used to track fouls previously for another team, and that was fine. And then I went to under 16s, and I'm like, wow.
Yeah, it happens quick.
It happens quick, so if you're not ready.
But you need some rules and roles around this. So if you are tracking fouls and you tell your head coach, you know, late, you probably don't have the chance to get the sub in. So can you make the sub for them? Well, you shouldn't just do it. That should be a discussion that's been had between the head coach and the assistant coach prior to that, because if, as an example, a player does pick up a foul that is going to cause a sub, but your head coach is down the other end of the bench talking to a player, you may need to go and pull the trigger on that one without talking to the head coach, who then looks around and goes, where's this come from? Why has this happened? Then you can say, hey, third foul. They have to come out. And it's like, well, okay, good. That's better than having them in there and picking up another foul. So if you are charged with that, do that well and be on top of that thing.
100%, because that can change the course of a game.
Yep.
Unbelievably so. But we had that sort of agreement with what we're doing. If you can't get my attention because I'm doing something else, I trust you to make the sub. And there were a couple of times where you'd bring our best player out and I'd turn and look at you and you're like, third. And I'm like, oh, cool. Like, but again, that's a similar thing when we're talking about the head coaches at the start. Like, don't turn and rip them first. Find out what the reasoning was, and then we can all just move on, because I see a lot of head coaches react to those things poorly, and the poor assistant coach is sitting there like, I was just doing actually what was right.
But also prepare them that the head coach may override it at the end of the day as well.
For sure.
So don't get upset if you went to make the sum. Go, no, cancel that. Don't worry about it. I know he's on three. It's all good.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, don't do the, oh, well, that was my job now.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, you told me to do this.
Do you want me to? Yeah. Like, it just takes maturity, really, to understand that. Because a lot of the time when a head coach does that, they're not doing it to make you look silly or to undermine you or to do anything. They're doing it because that's what they believe. And at the end of the day, like we mentioned earlier, they're the ones that lose their job if 100%. Something goes wrong, or, you know, so they have to be 100% on what's happening. So it is never personal. It is always just them trying to do what they think is right. Now, whether you agree with that or not is irrelevant.
Support publicly, but question privately.
Correct.
Like that might be something you discuss with the head coach afterwards. Like, hey, why didn't you want that? And sometimes it might just be, hey, gut feel was we didn't need that sub. Okay, cool. Like, no problems with it. But again, back to your point earlier of the head coach talking to the assistant coach, how you deliver that message matters.
Yeah.
Because there might be some hurt feelings within that, and you do need to be understanding as to how you communicate that to them. So the better the relationship, I think, with that, the better traction you're going to have. One thing I did notice at CMC, Country Metro Challenge, which was separated this year for a couple of reasons. But one thing I did notice, because those coaches were thrown in with an assistant coach they didn't really know. like they had no opportunity to get a rapport or get a feel of understanding, is there was a lot of double dipping with a head coach giving the instruction, but then the assistant coach giving the same instruction to someone.
That's what I was talking about before. Yeah, same thing on my end. Is. Yep.
Like it happened a lot. So you were at the metro side, I was at the countryside for this. And I understand it, like I get it, and it comes from a good place of coaches wanting to do the right thing and give the players all the information and those sorts of things. What are the things that really matter? Because ultimately, if the head coach is talking as the assistant coach, you shouldn't be. Like that is a really important thing that you need to make sure the right message is being heard by the right people. And if you're interfering with that message and also at the very end of it, or talking when they're talking, that's not helpful.
Or grabbing the group after a timeout.
Hate it.
Oh, my goodness. I can't stand that.
That's one that really doesn't.
But give them empower them a little bit as well. For them a chance to have a conversation very quick, obviously, like Zoe said as well, like 10 seconds max of this is what I'm saying. Okay, cool. One message goes across. Because I saw the same thing where timeout happened and one of the coaches just pulled a kid aside to talk to him about something else, even though he's not on the court, he needs to listen to that.
Yes.
Because if you're getting rotated on, you don't talk.
As you say, though, it's got to be quick.
Yeah.
Because there were a couple of coaching staffs there. I'm not ragging on anyone at all because they got given this feedback, but it is something I see fairly regularly. The amount of times a timeout would be called, the head coach wanders off out and towards split line somewhere because they need their time to think beforehand. The assistant coach is like, well, now what do I do? Do I follow them or do I jump into the timeout and start giving the information? You've got to have a bit of a process around your timeout and that sort of space, because there were times where the assistant coach would go, and this, and this, and this, and this, and this, and this, and the head coach is like, one, I don't know which message to take at this point, because if you've given me nine things that are all important, which one's none the one that really matters? But then I've got to jump into a timeout now and I've only got 7 seconds left because you've talked my ear off for the entire 50 seconds before the ref's jumping in to say, hey, you need to come back. You have to be quick and efficient. And it is dot points. This. That's it.
Yeah, the old sound bites.
It really is. It's not a conversation.
Yeah.
Like, because I don't think in that situation, as a head coach, I want to hear what the assistant coach has to say, and then it's my job to process that, filter out what I need, and then what I'm going to use. So for mine, it's tell me what you think. Great. I'm not going to go back to you with anything. I might talk to you after the timeout about why this or why not, etc. But give it to me short and sharp, and then it's my job to go in.
And what to talk about. If head coaches don't give you anything, this is some of the feedback I gave to the CMC coaches. If they don't give you anything to talk about, but you need to focus on something, pick on ball coverage. Because it happens so much it's going to be important.
Yep.
It's like, hey, this is working really well. Maybe we can switch this. Maybe we can blitz it, whatever. Yep. But
it's also a case of, like you said, have that process. So our process, whether you were assisting me or I was assisting you, was – timeout comes whether – so if you're an assistant coach, you'll often know that the timeout's coming before it comes, because if the opposition has called it, you'll hear from the bench that it's coming. And I would always say, and you would always do the same, Rob, hey, timeout coming. If you heard that, again, that's just another little thing that, you know, now he can start thinking and I can start thinking about what we're going to talk about and what's important. But grab the whiteboard, and as you're handing the whiteboard to the head coach, that's when you have your, you know, 5 to 10 seconds, and then you're out. And so if you've always got that, it means the head coach will, more often than not, unless they're about to lose it, come to you, and you can have that discussion really, really quickly. Rather than, you know, like we've all seen head coaches trying to find the whiteboard and that wastes time as well. So if you've got that process in place, it means you will always get a touch point with the head coach pre-timeout, which means you then don't have to come in or feel the need to come in and this, because if they've chosen not to speak about it, then they don't think it's important for right now, and that's okay.
Well, they're still processing it. You don't know what they're thinking. I think the whiteboard one's such an important one. I've had so many instances where I'm annoyed, and then I'm really annoyed, and it could have been avoided. I could have stayed at annoyed, right? Like, if I just had my whiteboard.
Yes.
But it is amazing how many times, and this is separate to assistant coaches, a coach calls a timeout and then walks out of the timeout and says, man, you called it. Like, you know what you've called the timeout for. Just jump in there straight away and go and address what you need to address. But it was interesting up at CMC, and I won't go the full coach shout-out music, but I was sitting behind a bench in particular with Sam, who was the head coach, and Ciro, who was the assistant coach. And it got to the end of the second quarter, and there was a dead ball. Timeout got called, and I heard Ciro go up to Sam and say, hey, I think we can trap this in the backcourt, and, you know, I think we can try and speed them up and get after it a little bit. And Sam's like, yep, agree, like, really good point. Jumped in. Hey, as Ciro said, this, like, acknowledge the assistant coach for coming there.
That's awesome. Like, I love the really coach assist. So like, love really the coach like assist.
That. But so I went to him after the game and said, hey, whose idea was that? I knew whose it was. Like, I heard it happen. It literally was 4 feet in front of me. And Ciro's like, hey, team decision. I'm like, attaboy.
Even
like, like, really good job. But it is. As a coaching staff, you win together, you lose together.
Yeah.
It's not divide and conquer. It's not, oh, I thought this. Everyone can be an expert as an assistant coach. Oh, yeah, I said we should have got out of that zone a little bit earlier, and they didn't. So, you know, that's on the coach. No. You win together, you lose together. That's how it is. Ultimately, the win and the loss is really separate. Are you creating a good experience for the athletes? And as a coaching staff and as a team, you have to be able to do that together. Because if you two are fighting as head coach and assistant coach, what are your players sitting there on the bench going, what the heck is going on here? Like, I don't know who I can talk to anymore because they both look angry and annoyed.
Yeah.
Like, this is not a real nice area to be in. The other part of it is when you're an assistant coach at training sessions, don't stand with your head coach. Stand somewhere. Like, I'm really critical of coaching staffs that stand together at training sessions because it's like, well, you're coaching one area of the court now. Divide that thing up. Like, if you're lucky enough to have an assistant coach, one at the top of the key, one on the baseline. If you've got three, top of the key, baseline, sideline, whatever it might look like, don't stand together.
I feel like you shouldn't stand still.
No. Well, you should be moving.
If you're coaching on the fly, you should just be circling. Well, I mean, that's what I – that's me.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of times I do see head coach and assistant coach just hanging out together. It's like, hey, the drill's going and, you know, we're doing what we're doing. Let's just sit here and talk about what's going on. And they're not coaching anymore. So it just avoids that because I've always had with my session plans, look, here's how long we want the drill to go for. Here's what the drill is. Here are the teaching points within it. Here are the coach roles within that again. So, okay, we're talking on-ball screen coverages. Nick, can you be over the show? And that's your sole focus is deal with the show. Zoe, can you be on the help defender? Like, make sure there is someone in the tag spot the entire way through. So you have a specific role because nothing creates buy-in like knowing what you're buying into.
But as an assistant coach, if you get given that role, do the role.
Yeah.
Like, I've seen a lot of coaches be given those roles. And so as like the head coach, if I'm then having to cover your role, so that let's say it's hand pressure, for example, if I'm then having to come in and coach that, what are you doing? Like, you should be on that before I get to it. And it's one of the things I say to my coaches all the time, especially when we're at camps, don't give me an opportunity to break into your session or to your basket. Mm. So you address these issues because I'm walking around watching all the courts. Don't give me an opportunity to come on and say, stop, do this. You know, I want you to be active and fix that. So if you're given a role, it's not – busy work. It's not to, you know, try and just get you out of the head coach's way. It's because it's something that matters. So do be on top of that. Be the best version of that or give the best version of that that you can. So then your head coach goes, right, that like we made improvements there and it's largely because of you. Next time, you know, we're going to take it to another level. You might get something of more importance, you might get a whole drill that you have to run yourself, you know, all those sort of things. It helps build trust with your head coach.
It does. And that's impossible to fake. I feel like you know when you're not trusted as an assistant coach and similar as a head coach, when you don't have full faith in what's going on. It's a real lonely feeling because you're driving to stuff and it's like, why am I driving to this? Like, this is not a good environment for me to be in or what have you.
Yeah, just to show up.
Yeah, it's no good. So find out what your head coach needs. Find out what your players need. Ask them, like, what do you want when you come off? Because you're more likely to talk to the players than the head coach is, I think, as the assistant coach. So, and that continues to off-court stuff, whether it be planning and preparation. If you're the coach that's on the scout, no worries. That's your job. Like, go get that done as best you can possibly get that done. If you've got some spare time at the end to do something else, cool. Like, no problems with it. But do your stuff first and get that done. When you're working as a cohesive coaching staff, that's an important part of it. You'll have personality clashes throughout. And that's you know, part of life. That's not necessarily, you know, exclusive to coaching. You don't have to like everyone, but there have been some people that I don't like that I've really enjoyed working with because their personalities have not been, hey, I'm friends with you. It has been, I really like how you do this, where you come from, and it's just worked. It's been cohesive. Like, and that's, we still get along. We're functioning adults. We're not, you know, completely incapable of that. But it's like, well, I'm not hanging out with you afterwards. Like, that's a different thing altogether.
Yeah, I think with assistant coaches, though, making sure that if you're given a job that you think is beneath you, understand that the head coach has probably done that in their time too. It's not, yeah, you know, I had an assistant coach who I gave filming a game to in our first game and was clearly unhappy with it. But it was on a rotation. Everyone was getting a turn. It just happened that he was first. So we got to the end of the day. I asked for the film and he didn't press record. So from then on...
In his defence.
The thing is, because of the performance that was put on when he was given the role, my brain automatically goes to sabotage. It wasn't an... Well, we've all made mistakes before. And
oh, yeah. I constantly forget to turn the camera.
Because like, yeah. You watch
and
the game. Like,
yeah. Hey, someone's on the break and my head turns, but the camera stays
watch
where
the
it
game
is.
Through the camera.
Yeah, yeah.
It's better than standing in front of it, I got to tell you.
But, you know, that I filmed tons of games because that's what you have to do, though. If it's a job that needs doing, it's not above or beneath anybody. And it's a... I think a really big point for, especially if you're normally a head coach and then you step into an assistant coach role, understand that, you know, that's a part of it and it's needed for the group.
Yeah, and it is difficult. Like there's sometimes there's work that you don't want to, like everyone wants to do the cool stuff. Like everyone wants
game
to be
coach.
Pacing, like yeah. Pace the sidelines or I've got the play at the end of the game. And everyone wants to do those sorts of things for sure. And it is a cautionary tale, I think, for a lot of young coaches in particular, that just because you're involved with a team at a certain level doesn't mean you've necessarily made it as a coach. Like, you're not there on your coaching ability. You might be there on your age and your ability to develop long term. That might be just a little bit of a stepping stone for you in that sort of space. So you do have to be a little bit careful that, hey, remember, you're still a long way from the head coaching chair. And consequently, you're still a long way from all the pressure that comes with the head coaching chair. So you do have to be a little bit careful of that. But, I mean, I do like the idea of a young assistant coach that's going to learn and develop and all those sorts of things. You just need to make sure that you still give them some guardrails. It's like, hey, every now and again, let them fail, but just make sure that, okay, look, wasn't what we thought it was going to be. And it might be as simple as, like I remember talking to a coach that went to an Oz camp once, and it was their first Oz camp. They were super excited. And they're like, hey, you've got the first drill. And they're like, oh, okay, no worries. What do you want it to be? And they're just like, oh, you know, five-player weaves. And like everyone would have done five-player weaves since they've entered the – their coach has never been more stressed in their lives about getting this right, and the demonstration had to be perfect and the teaching points had to be perfect. It's like, you know what, you're overcomplicating something. Like this is something that's really easy. They know what it is. You know what it is. Your job is to just get it set up and get it going. We don't need the – so we're going to catch on this foot and this is going to leverage into what this is going to – relax. Just get the stuff right that needs to be done. So that's a big part, I think, for mine. Assistant coaches, like I said, I'd prefer to get a young assistant coach where I can. My thing is create a bit of a legacy piece of that coach can then go on and coach somewhere else. Something else in whatever capacity that might be. So lots of things for the coaches out there to take into consideration when we're talking assistant coaches. Hopefully, if there are any other thoughts that you have, by all means, email them through and we'll get to them as soon as we can get to them.
Something to post on Facebook. Let's go.
It's like me on Twitter.
So this one's from college coach Kelvin Sampson. Talking, he was asked at a press conference and you'll hear where it was asked.
All these daddies got enough money to hire people to go work these kids out. What does that do? Ain't nobody guarding you. You know, if we was playing in a 1-0 tournament, I think you'd be pretty good. Problem is, we play 5-on-5. You can't learn to play basketball and make reads and make the right play and figure out where the help's coming from and where should I make this pass or pass the roll or if I'm getting double teamed, can I pass to the corner? Because nobody's ever guarding you. It's one thing I like about JoJo. There ain't nobody ever worked JoJo out, I promise you. But JoJo played 5-on-5 on the blacktop. He's a hoop. Sometimes you need to get somebody and go play against somebody and see if you can guard them. When you're playing 1-on-0, who are you guarding? And who's guarding you? Can you handle pressure? Can you work on going left against pressure, going right against pressure? So the thing I would tell kids coming up is spend more time playing basketball than working on basketball.
So really cool little sound grab. Like Kelvin Sampson's been around for an eternity in that coaching space in particular. But it is a cautionary tale that just because you're working out doesn't mean you're actually working on anything. You do have to be a little bit careful with that. But the reads and everything goes with it. Play. Like figure out, like set some time aside in your training sessions to play. There was a year where we had like a little King of the Hill tournament. We had it. So like the last 10 minutes of every training session was King. Like, so King for those was just one-on-one. That's what we called it back in the 90s-ish when I was rolling through. Like, it was literally one-on-one. The ball would start under the basket. They'd pitch it out to the person at the top of the key. You play one-on-one. There might be dribble limits. There might be nothing else, whatever it was. But we would have that at the last 10 to 15 minutes of every training session because it was something that the kids would enjoy, that they'd buy into. But they got to work on things that we've potentially worked on in a training session. They get to have a little bit of fun, creativity. Yes, it created some times where they were sitting in lines for a little bit too longer, but we'd have like a 9-second shot clock on it. So we'd churn through kids pretty quickly. And we had a championship belt that went with that. So if you were the last one standing at the end and you won, you walked out with the belt, but you had to bring it back next week. And that was a thing. Like your job was to try and defend that belt for as many weeks as you could defend that belt. But they had more fun in that drill than anything else I was doing at the training sessions. And I thought I was living a fairly good training session at that point, but they enjoyed the one-on-one pickup. So tie into that. Like that for mine is a really big thing that I think we can do as coaches is give your kids an opportunity to play. The on-zero stuff, okay, you might need to demonstrate something so that they can see what the movement feels like and those sorts of things first. Like if you're talking on like pick and pop as an example, then a kid may never have picked and popped in their life. They've always been a pick and roll kid, so you might want to show it one-on-zero so they can understand what the footwork feels like coming off a flare screen. What does the footwork feel like? But then throw defense in there as quickly as you possibly can and make it competitive and make them have to make decisions, I think is the important part of that.
Yeah, I see a lot of, obviously here at State Basketball Center, we see a lot of athletes working out. Yeah, working out. And
parents?
I do wonder about sometimes why the coach is there. Because is it...
Rebounder.
Are they just a rebounder? Because that exact soundbite has it just perfect in that if there's nobody there to defend it or to cause a decision or other than volume, like what are you getting out of that? And if you want volume, does a coach need to be there? I don't know. I've questioned it a lot, so it's nice to hear something like that.
Yeah, definitely. Like, it's something to consider, though.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I always just believe that the best basketball players are the best decision makers and you're not really working on that when you're on zero. Yep. That's just my opinion.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, coaches, something to consider when you're designing session plans. Talk to your assistant coach. See what you can get in there. See how we've come full circle. Parents. You know, it's... No. Behaviour in general. That is something that genuinely does need to be addressed. So please be mindful of that, coaches, as you're involved in that sort of space. Thanks, everyone, for jumping back in. I know it's been a little bit between podcasts, but we are back on the regular now. So we will catch everyone again next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.